Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response of the day for the 3rd of Shivat. This is from Shutzit Eliezer, Chelek Zayin Simon Mem, from the 7th volume, the 40th responsum, and it's from the 3rd of Shivat of Tufshin Chof Bet of 1962. Shutzit Eliezer received a letter from Amsterdam. In Amsterdam, there was a professor of psychology in the University of Leiden, and he was, and the responsibility was Nechdo Shel Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, which would theoretically mean that he was a grandson of Rav Yaakov Ettlinger. Now, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger passed away in 1871. This is 1962. It's theoretically possible that he's a grandson, but I think Nechdo might just mean a descendant of. He might have been a great-grandson or even a great-great-grandson. But in any case, he's a descendant of Yaakov Ettlinger's, who wrote the Aruch Lanier, is an important rabbi, and this university, this man, this professor of psychology, is an observant Jew, Shomer Torah Mitzvot, he keeps the Torah, but he and his wife were not blessed with children, and they decided to adopt, and so they wanted to adopt a Jewish girl, a Jewish child. It happened to be a girl that they got, but they wanted to adopt a Jewish child. They couldn't find any in Europe. There was no possibility of finding a Jewish baby in Europe, so there was a certain person in Holland who was in Morocco, and when he was in Morocco, he was a friend of this professor's family. He was in Morocco, and he came back, and he tells him, you know, in Casablanca, there's an orphanage. Yeah, an orphanage. And the administrator of this orphanage was a Catholic French doctor. And he had told this guy that they have there a Jewish baby. And she was born from a single mother. And the father was married. And the father was one of the higher-ups. He was one of the rich men of the Jewish community of Casablanca, and he was embarrassed that he had a child out of wedlock, and I assume that his wife was also not happy about it. So they put the little girl in a Catholic hospital, orphanage, whatever it was, and to raise her, but the condition was they wanted her to be adopted by a traditional Jewish family, a family. So Masoretut sometimes means traditional, and they aren't so careful about mitzvos. Sometimes it means they are careful about mitzvos, but a traditional Jewish family. So, and the father, the man, the rich Casablanca man, had paid all of the costs to the orphanage to raise her, all the hospital costs, all whatever it would cost to raise her, they'd given her. So we hear about this, they're very excited. The wife of this psychology guy, of this descendant of the Aruch Lanier, goes to Casablanca, to Morocco, to pick up the baby, to adopt the baby. And the administrator there shows her in the records of the institution that this baby, like it's written already, this baby must be adopted only by a Jewish family. And now she's been there for 5 years. So they're raising this girl for 5 years. They have her in the house. And now somebody says to them, you know, you're going to have big problems with her. When she grows up, people aren't going to be sure that she's Jewish. And they might decide that she has to convert. And then they'll also decide that she can't marry a Kohen. Even if they decide she doesn't have to convert, they'll decide she can't marry a Kohen because if she's a convert, or if she's adopted and she was originally non-Jewish and converted, she's not allowed to marry a Kohen. So all of a sudden people are raising these questions to them about whether they can assume that she's Jewish or they have to convert her. And therefore, or connected to that, can they assume she's Jewish enough and that we're sure enough that she's Jewish and that she doesn't have other problems in her lineage that she can marry a Kohen when she grows up. So on this 3rd of Shvat, 1962, Tufshin Chof Bet, the Sicilian writes that he got the letter 2 days ago. And since the guy is writing that he needs the answer very quickly, and he is got his own thing, so therefore he's only gonna write in great brevity. So he's writing very quickly because I very often mishivim wait a week or 2 weeks before they get a chance to answer questions. So he says he thinks that there's no need for her to convert. She's definitely Jewish, and these are the reasons that he's going to give. So the question is, what can we trust and what can we not trust in the evidence that we have that will lead us to be sure, to be confident that she's Jewish? So the first thing is, he says, it's clear that the mother was Jewish because the man who, the French doctor who runs the orphanage, who revealed, who said that this is from a Jewish mother, he was being Mesiach Lefi Tumon. Mesiach Lefi Tumon is a category in Halacha about non-Jews, about other people who we might otherwise not trust, but if they're saying something, they don't realize the consequences of what they're saying. They're just telling us information that from their perspective does not carry any particular weight or importance. That's called being a Messiah Lefi Tumo. They're just talking, and there, very often, they have a greater level of believability than they might if they knew the stakes for us, and they knew they were testifying for us on issues that matter for us. In addition, Tisalesha points out this is what's called a milta d'avida d'igluye. Milta d'avida d'igluye means if you say something and the truth is going to come out one way or the other, it's easy to come out. So therefore, also, it ups your believability because we can't imagine you'll lie about something when you know you're going to get caught in the lie, or you have good reason to think you're going to get caught in the lie. In addition, the fact that everybody knows that the father is this rich guy in Casablanca who's paying for her upkeep until she gets adopted, so that helps also because there's Yerushalmi with the Pnei Yosha, in Yevamot, where the Pnei Yosha said that even, Pnei Moshe said, that even if somebody's not a Messiah Lefi Tuma, but if she is Mar'a Panim Lidvarha, a non-Jewish woman, or a Jewish woman who we couldn't believe for some reason, but she gave evidence what she was saying. So, for example, in this case, the example is Tamar, when she says that Yehuda is the father, so you might have thought not to believe her because she's not a Messiah Lefi Tuma because it matters to her a lot, and maybe at that time she wasn't Jewish yet, or whatever the definitions of those would be. But the key point here is that she pulls out Yehuda's staff and his knapsack, his tarmil, and his makel, right, his sack, and his thing, so that's evidence. So in evidence cases, even if somebody's not a Messiah Lefi Tuma, there's more reason to believe them. So to hear. In addition, the mother, the adopted mother of this girl, the wife of this professor who's asking the question, saw it written down in the pinkes, written down in the notebook, in the records of the hospital, that she had been sent, dropped off there by a Jewish mother with a pig, and that the rules are that only a Jew is allowed to adopt them. So she saw that evidence for herself. That also helps us. For all of that, still just think, we don't have to really think about whether she's Jewish or not, and whether or not this original Dutch guy who told him about it was a Messiah Lefi Tumo. In addition, it's also, besides being a Milta David Gluye, he says it's also true that the people in charge of this hospital are official government representatives, right? The man who runs the orphanage, the hospital, is a government official. And there we have a general principle also, which is that Chazaka Uman Lo Mira Umnute, that in general, an artisan won't do anything to endanger his craft. In other words, let's say a guy has it's not just an artisan like somebody who does the arts, but somebody who has a job, and the job is based on a certain expertise and a certain reliability of his expertise, so that person, we think in halacha, generally avoids doing things that will endanger their business, right? It would be like if I said today, you can generally assume, it's not always true, unfortunately, but you can generally assume that accountants won't themselves violate tax laws in their professional business, encourage others to, because if they get caught, they'll lose their profession. Now, we've seen in our times that's not always true of lawyers, not always true of accountants, not always true of doctors even, but it is a halachic presumption that it is generally true. And therefore, here too, this man is the head of an orphanage, and that's his job, and part of his job is to be a trustworthy fiduciary for the children that come his way, and that helps, even if we weren't to think he was a Messiah Lefi Tuma, that helps us believe that we understand, that helps us to assume that we can believe him. And he says he found another tshuva like that said the same thing about 62 Jewish children who were brought into an orphanage in Vienna among lots of non-Jewish children, but they were clearly allowed to, but the tshuva said they're allowed to believe the authorities who said which were rich because, again, it's a matter of not being mira umnute, because they are government officials and they don't want to be caught telling untruths and therefore lose their reliability. It's also true that aside from the question of umanim, of people who have a profession, and whether they will or won't lie under those conditions, they're also an extra added believability to what's called erchaot, to the official government things. That's aside from professionals, the government things also, that in various situations that we will accept their testimony. So, for example, in certain aguna cases, if you have a governmental record or deed or some kind of proof that rose to their standards, that helps us, and that they accepted that testimony, that will help us as well. He says, and that explains why there's no contradiction between that and you have a Maharival who had a tshuva where he said that if a kutit, now a kutit is a non-Jew perhaps, or somebody who's not quite Jewish, or we're not sure of their Judaism. She said, so a kutit brings a little girl, and she says that it was a Jew who gave this little girl to her to nurse, lahanika. There, you can say, well, that's just a random kutit, and also, you might think that her whole intent and her whole purpose, her whole idea is that they're going to get money from the Jews to pay her for what she's been doing, or to pay her to continue doing it. And therefore, you have reason to think not to believe her, right? She's not a siach lefi tumah. She's bringing it to us directly. She's not an official person. She's not a professional. She doesn't have connection to the government. And she stands to profit from this. So in all those situations, there's reasons not to believe her. But that's none of that's relevant to here. He says, by the way, another thing here is that the hospital that this little girl was in was a missionary hospital. So he says, if in a missionary hospital they had any suspicion that the baby was not Jewish, was Christian, they would certainly want to keep her because they want to keep her and raise her in the faith that they believe in. And therefore, he says, that's added proof and added idea that we can trust them that this little girl is in fact Jewish. Once we know that she's Jewish, then the question is, can we trust that she's got enough of a valid lineage? Can we be sure enough of her lineage that that she can marry a Kohen when she grows up if she wants to as well? So he says the fact that the rich man in the Casablanca paid for all of her hospital needs, now theoretically you could say that that was just a function of him being a nice guy, but they're just saying no. The fact that he paid for all of her hospital needs would tell us that he really is the father. So that would mean that we know who the father is, we know who the mother is. If we know who the father is, we know who the mother is. And by the way, the fact that the father is in an affair when he has the baby does not affect the baby's... it's not affect the baby's status in terms of lineage, in terms of halacha, in terms of being able to marry a Kohen. It's an interesting thing, right? There are marks on lineages that we today, you know, colloquially and intuitively have more of a problem with than halacha does. And one example of that would be, if she wasn't Jewish and converted, is one that other people might think should be a problem that halacha does. And if she's born out of wedlock to two perfectly fine Jewish parents, but they weren't married to each other at the time, that would not be an issue. That would be a concern or a worry. And it happens to be that at the time of the birth, the woman who gave birth had said that he was the father. So in general there, Hare Ne'emenet L'Hakshir HaVlad, she's believed to tell us who the Vlad, who the baby should be. Or I should say, who the father of the baby is. He says, by the way, there are authorities who hold that you can say she can marry a Kohen we don't have no idea who the father is, if it's Rov Prutzim, but we paskin that way, that as long as the people who she's likely to have had relationship with, even if we don't believe her, if all the people she's likely to have had relationship with are not people who would possibly the baby L'Kahuna, then we would accept that as well. And he says, V'pasa kein gam acharon ha-poskim ha-arach ha-shulchan. The latest of the poskim, this is what this is writing in 1962, the arach ha-shulchan. Now I think he means having written a whole sefer about it, but it's to me an interesting contrast with the Mishnah Berurah, because the Mishnah Berurah is right around the same time as the arach ha-shulchan. I don't think he's before the arach ha-shulchan. So unless the Tzitzit just means the arach ha-shulchan came later, I think he means he thinks of the arach ha-shulchan as more of a posek than he does the Mishnah Berurah, I think, but I'm not sure. In any case, added to that, he says, another factor to say she can marry a Kohen is that there are Rishonim and Poskim, not that we generally rule this way, but there are Rishonim and Poskim who hold that if a, I'm not sure how we hold in general, but I think we don't generally hold this way, that if a Jewish woman has relations with a non-Jewish man and they have a baby, that that baby also can marry a Kohen. So if that's true, then certainly we have no worries here, because we know who the mother is, right? The mother came in and gave birth. She was Jewish. So even though the father was a non-Jew, there are those who hold that the baby could marry a Kohen. And then finally he throws in that there's another issue that comes up. The Maharaj Dam pointed out, this is already in the 1500s, pointing out that we hold that today, the people who we hold are Kohanim, we're not positive they're Kohanim. We're not sure. They don't have, most of them, almost all of them, don't have direct lineages straight all the way back to a well-verified Kohen, a well-verified priest. So therefore, today, when we treat people like a Kohen, is because they say they're a Kohen. Their family tradition is they're a Kohen. So we believe them, and we treat them that way, which is fine. And in general halachic purpose, that's what we rely on. I will say that I've heard of great rabbis who always tried to do pidyon haben. They tried to find what's called the Kohen HaMiuchas. There are very few Kohanim who have like a lineage going way enough back that they really feel like they can really prove that they're Kohanim. And they would, if they want to do a mitzvah like pidyon haben, a biblical mitzvah that is required of Kohen, they would look for one with a full yichus. But in general, the Kohanim we have are good enough. But when it comes to this question, the Sitzel just says, if you're going to point out that Kohanim today are Kohanim Chazakah, they're not completely verified in their status of Kohen. So in general, we don't rely on that. But here, this would be another factor, because you could say, let's even say everything we've said was not true. And let's even say that we have to worry that she's not allowed to marry a Kohen. If she marries somebody who thinks of himself as a Kohen, he might not actually be a Kohen. Now, he doesn't mean that therefore that person would have to declare themselves a non-Kohen to be able to marry her. He just means that since when he says he's a Kohen, what he means is, my family tradition is that I'm a Kohen, and what we mean halakhically is, that's good enough for her to treat you as a Kohen, but we're not completely, absolutely sure, then it might be that even within those parameters, he can marry this young woman. And therefore, the consistent of the answer concludes that you should encourage them, and they should feel calm and comfortable and serene, especially since they're raising this girl who otherwise might have been left in that orphanage, and now they're raising her in a Jewish family, in the Jewish tradition, and the great merit of the Aruch Laner should help them out and encourage them in all the good signs of things. So that's the first tshuva that I wanted to see. I just didn't want to, it's not really long enough to take up our time, but I didn't want to leave it behind because I thought it was such an interesting question of when people out of goodwill are doing something out of goodwill, sometimes the answer is we can't help you. This is an example of an answer where they could help them and encourage them and reassure them, and I thought it was kind of nice, and it also shows us issues that come up in terms of ne'emanut, which is what we do believe and don't believe about lineage and parents and when we believe non-Jews and when their professions can help them and all those kinds of issues. I thought it was interesting issues to bring up. So, with the time that's left with us, I want to see another tshuva in the Tzitzit Ezra. This is from Chelek Yud Zayin, from Volume 17, Simon Samach Gimel, the 63rd responsive in the book. Also from the 3rd of Shvat, from Tuf Shin Mem Zayin, from 1987. He raises an issue that somebody had seen in, or he had seen, in a halachic book on Haggadah of Pesach by Shmuel Avigdor. And this Shmuel Avigdor had said that we should teach people when the Kiddush is said, they should say it to themselves, they should say Vayichulu to themselves, word for word, reading it out of Haggadah. Because if they don't, there's a problem. And the problem is, there's a halacha in the Gemara of Dvarim Shevichtav Yata Rashai La'omran Be'alpen. This comes up in a lot of context, that the Tanakh, which was given in writing, is not material that we are allowed to say orally, by heart. So if the person saying Kiddush is saying it by heart, and we're listening to him, even if he's not saying it by heart, but if we're listening to him and we're just hearing it, that's a problem. So if he's got a sitter in front of him and he's reading out of a sitter, then we don't have to say it after him, because then you can say he's reading it. It's not Shabbat. So that was the issue. And then, so then the person asked, so the question says, but there might be other ways to get around this problem, to think that it's not such a big issue. Because, for example, when it comes to davening, we say that something is shagor befiv, something that is known, well known to people, like, let's say, the first line of Shema, everybody knows. There, we don't go and create Shema, so then there are poskim who say that the halacha of, you know, let's say them by heart, doesn't come into play. I will say on that, it's just me talking, but I will say on that that I know in my own experience there are times when there are things that we think we know by heart and we don't actually know by heart as well as we do, and therefore it might be worth even reading, getting used to reading those things inside as well. But that's a whole different issue. But as a technical question, there's halachic room to say that if people know something well and it's just well known by to everybody, that doesn't fall under the rubric of the halacha of that if it's a matter of Tanakh, if it's verses in Tanakh, you don't have to say it by heart. But and then even if it's true about certain things that you can do that by heart, but that would only be for your own personal needs. But in terms of being motzi other people, in terms of helping other people, the whole issue of saying it by heart or not saying it by heart, when you know it or not, is not when you're going to help other people fulfill their obligation. If you're helping other people fulfill their obligation, it would seem that you need to read it word for word, and it seems like poskim agree about this. Rishonim and Achronim all agree about this, and yet that's not at all the custom. So this person is writing to the Tzitzit Ezer, wants to know What can you do? And his own thoughts were, maybe you can rely on those who say that if even the people hearing it know it by heart, know it well, and therefore they'll be able to spot any mistakes, and it's not like it's being said by al-peh, maybe that makes it okay, even if you're not reading it from a text. Or maybe those who say that, no, you have to read it out of text, they only meant that those things, they thought that the rule of things that are written, you can't say by heart, wasn't a matter of what you can say and not say, it was what you can say in a tzibur, in a communal setting, or not. Or maybe you can say that since the person making kiddush has to say yichvaychilu himself, and he's allowed to say because it's shogrim, if that everybody agrees. If you're saying something for your own personal mitzvah obligation, and it's well known to you, so there everybody says you're allowed to say it by heart, even as long as you know it well. So maybe since the guy saying kiddush is able to do so because he knows it well, maybe that's good enough to be able to fulfill other people's obligations as well. So now this comes to his answer. He says, all of your reasons are very sensible and they make sense, but each one has a problem with it as the guy wrote about it. I just skipped the other side of the question. Each one has the other side of the question because they're opposed to disagree. And you might have said also, you might have gotten into the idea that this whole halacha of things that are written, you can't say by heart. There's a whole question about what's obligatory and what's not obligatory about it. Some people say it's a mitzvah min muvchar, it's just the best way to handle it. Some people say there's a Tosfot Yishanim in Yoma says that. But others say, no, it's an actual drabbanon. And some people even think that's a d'oraita. So when you're getting around this issue, you have to think about what you're getting around and how you're doing it, because there's somewhat of a problem there. And therefore, you have a machloket about it. And you would think, in a situation like this, where it's relatively easy, you would say to people, okay, then you have to do it the best possible way. You should really try to be reading it out of a Haggadah to yourselves as the person saying Kiddush is saying Kiddush. So this is, he thinks he has a better answer, an answer that will get around all of this issue. It will get us away from all of this issue. In other words, you know, the person writing him had been trying to say, this is a real issue, we get the issue, and these are ways around it. But still, I think Vayichulu might be a completely exceptional case. And the reason he says that is because Vayichulu is said Friday night as a matter of bearing testimony to the fact that Hashem created the world in 6 days. So if that's true, and it's a matter of testimony is generally said standing, and that, for example, is the reason why the halacha is that one has to stand, is supposed to stand, for the beginning part of Friday Night Kiddush. There's a whole discussion whether you sit down at Bar Pigafin or not, but everybody agrees that for the Vayichulu part of Kiddush, you're supposed to stand, and that's because it's seen as an act of testimony. That's why also it's seen as preferable as having two people do it together. So if somebody's eating their own Friday night, so that's what they're doing, that's what happens. But for example, in shul, if you have people who take longer Friday night davening than the Amidah on Friday night, then the rest of the community, such that the rest of the community has already said Vayichulu by the time they finish, there are those who will try to make sure to find another person to join them in saying Vayichulu. Now, the reason that helps us to think of it as Edut, to think of it as actual testimony, is because in the case of Edut, there's a rule, Mipihem velo mipiktavam, that you're supposed to give Edut, you're supposed to give testimony orally, and not from written material. And therefore, now, there are going to be some cases where you can use written material, but fundamentally, Edut, testimony, is supposed to be oral. And therefore, he thinks that when Chazal said that we should say Vayichulu Friday nights, it's part of the original the original rule that you should say it, is that they meant to say it be'al-peh, they didn't say it by heart and not in writing. Now, what's interesting about that to me is that assumes, and the Tzitzis doesn't really get into to defend it, that assumes that the rule of Dvarim Shebichtav Yatayr Shalom Ram Be'al-Peh, that you can't say things that are written by heart, depends on why they were told to be said. That Chazal could come along and say that even though in general you can't say them by heart, here you have to say them by heart. In any case, it's not even true. We first have to point out that when it comes to testimony, Tzitzis knows there's a Pitkei Tshuva in Choshen Mishpat, in the name of the Ritva, but there are ways in which or a testimony can be given in writing. He says, for example, let's say somebody brings their written affidavit to a Beit Din, and they say to the Beit Din, what's written here, I am now telling you orally that I am telling you that I affirmatively testify to all of that. The Ritva held that was okay. The Ritva held that was considered oral. So you might think, oh, you see, you can give oral testimony in writing. So as it says, that's different because there he gives an oral declaration before the court and says, what's written here is what I'm testifying. But with Vayichulu, there's no court that you're giving the declaration in front of. And also, that's when you're giving like specific testimony about a specific case with all the details. But here, where you're just saying general principles that Hashem created the world in 6 days, so there you could say that that would be true. That you couldn't write down Vayichulu, let's say before Shabbos, and then Kiddush Friday night say, here's Vayichulu, I'm giving testimony to this. That's not true. And therefore, it shows you the Vayichulu, the testimony that we're giving in Vayichulu. So that's why he thinks that they instituted it as an oral declaration to begin with, and that all she said by alpeh, and everybody can hear it. And then maybe that's even the better way to do it by a heart, because it's part of testimony. Now, the whole idea that Chazal can institute that the halacha shouldn't apply, as I pointed out before, so this is, I think there's support for my claim that that's true in the Chatam Sofer in Yoredeya Simon Kuf Tzadi Aleph, where he writes, Lefi Aniyat Ta'ati, this is the Chatam Sofer writing, Lefi Aniyat Ta'ati, according to my opinion, the whole Shireti Hilot Ne'amarim Be'alpeh, the Me'ikara Hachinit Kindu, that all of Tehillim can be said by heart. And the reason why he says it is because originally that's the way they were said, and that's the way they were instituted. Because it doesn't make, so all the Tehillim that talk about that these are songs the Levim sang in the Beit HaMikdash, Lamenatzeach, and things like that, there's no reason to think when they originally said they were said from a book. It's not like we think the Levim, you know, the Levim were standing there in two rows, let's say, in the Beit HaMikdash, and they had papers in front of them. They just learned it, and they learned it by heart. So therefore, the fact that it got into Tanakh after that, basically, is what he's saying, or that it was in Tanakh, but they were then singing it in the Beit HaMikdash. So it seems like it was originally, this is what the Chatzim Sofer is saying, it seems like they were doing it by heart. So too with Hallel, which is in Tehillim, we have a tradition that when people were giving their Korban Pesach, when they're offering their Korban Pesach, as it was being offered, they would all sing Hallel. So if they were singing Hallel, that too would seem to have been by heart. The Chatzim Sofer says it would seem like those things were originally instituted singing by heart. Now there, theoretically, you could say that those at their moment of being inspired, meaning if it didn't come from David HaMelech, it depends on what you think, the whole book of Tehillim came from David HaMelech or not, but if it didn't, what he means is the Levim were inspired with this Tehillim and then they eventually made it into Tehillim, that could be slightly different. It wasn't yet Kitvei Kodesh, wasn't yet identified as Holy Writ, and therefore would be Devarim Shebichtav. But it's still just saying, no, he doesn't think it's true. He thinks that the Chatam Sofer means basically what he's saying. Harei kanal sheyachlu chazal tatkin, that chazal could be mitakin it that way. And don't say that he thinks that Tvarim Shebichtav is a halacha derabbanan, is a rabbinic rule. And if it's a rabbinic rule, you could say, well, that's why he thinks it's okay that sometimes they can decide to say certain things by heart, because after all, it's them and them. Right? If it's only a rabbinic rule to only say it, say things that are written, to prohibit saying orally things that are written, that's a rabbinic rule, then rabbis also have the power to say when that doesn't apply, and this would be an example of that. But there are people who hold that it's a Oraita rule, that people hold that it's a Torah rule. If it's a Torah rule, then you'll have more of a problem, right? But he says, nope, don't say that about Chatam Sofer, because if you look in his Chidushim to Gittin, if you look at his Navele on Gittin, at what he at his comments on Gittin, he says there explicitly that he thinks it's a Torah rule, that the Torah made the rule, the things that are written, you're not allowed to say orally. If so, when he says that there are times when Chazal can institute something and institute it orally, that should be applicable to other situations as well. And that the Torah's prohibition of saying things orally did not mean to include that. And that's the point. And that there was embedded in the original halachic rule of you can't say orally that which is written, which might be a Torah rule, but included in that was the idea that Chazal would have the power in certain situations to say these things don't count, these are exceptions, and you can say them by heart. There are more pieces, but they get pretty technical about which things of here are considered Eid Lasot Lashem. Some of this might be that the rule is the rule, but there are occasions in halacha where we violate the rules because of certain causes. So it might be that if there aren't enough Sidurim around, there aren't enough people to be able to have Sidurim, that might be an issue. There are various forms of the issue that come up. Eid Lasot Lashem is one of them. It might be that things that were for a tzibur, that were for a whole community, might be different than things that were for individuals or for families. But fundamentally, that's the basic answer to Tzitzis Yehuda gives, and he thinks that when it comes to Kiddush, the Friday night Kiddush, we have the right to say it by heart, even though it's Psukim, because it was made as Eidut, and once it was made as Eidut, that was part of, it was part of the original ruling that we can say it by heart. So, two responses of the Tzitzis Yehuda for the third of Shvat. One about an adopted girl being a fully acceptable Jew, marry a Kohen, everything is fine with her because we can trust the story of her lineage well enough not to have a worry. And the second being about Kiddush, that we can listen to the person saying Kiddush without having to have a sitter in front of us to repeat it along with them to ourselves, even though ordinarily Psukim in Tanakh are not allowed to be said by heart, with certain exceptions as we've noted. That's it for Shabbos Day. Have a great day.